Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 196 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and as always, we have co-hosts. This time, all three of them. Back with us this week is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hey, David.
Hey, guys. Thanks for permission to have the night off. It was a very lovely evening with my wife and a brief respite, but I'm back.
Excellent. We're glad to have you back. And also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Max, Rob, David, always good to be back.
Now, you have some school obligations tonight, I understand, so you may be peeling off a little early?
Yeah, I might be ducking a little early. I'm currently stuck in the end of semester project final paper mess, so I'll stick around for the news, and I think I might be ducking out.
Okay.
To finish things up.
We understand. All right, and the third co-host, of course, is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
In beautiful Chicago.
In beautiful, yes. Chicago.
We've had some fine thunderstorms out here. Spring thunderstorms in the last 24 hours. I mean, makes you realize that nature is at play as May begins.
Great. It's that time of year, so yeah, pretty exciting.
The cicadas can't be far behind.
Oh, I can hardly wait. Our guest this episode is Linda Maloney. Now, she's had a 20-year military career as a naval aviator. In fact, she's one of the first women to join a combat military flying squadron. Since then, she's provided engineering and technical support to the Navy's aviation acquisition programs, and she's also doing something in support of the Naval Undersea Warfare Center. I'm not sure what that is. But recently, she started My Mom Flies, a women and mom-focused network. She's also a motivational speaker, and maybe most exciting, she's authored her first book. It's called Military Fly Moms, Sharing Memories, Building Legacies, Inspiring Hope. Linda, welcome to the show.
Hi, Max, and hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me tonight. I'm very excited to talk with you all.
Now, we're excited, too. Now, Linda, maybe you can give us a brief idea of what aircraft you flew in the Navy.
Well, I first started out flying. I'm a naval flight officer, a right seater, and when I started flying in the military, it was before the combat exclusion law was repealed, and that meant that I could only fly in support-type squadrons. And so I flew in the two-seater A-7, and then I flew in the EA-6A, followed by the Prowler, the EA-6B, and that was my primary aircraft in the military.
And I understand that you had to exit one of them in flight.
I did. I was flying with another A-6 out of Key West, Florida, and we were going up to fly missions or training flights against the USS Forrestal when it was still in service, and we flew our flight, and we were coming off the Forrestal and flying into MacDill Air Force Base to get gas and go back out in the afternoon and do the same type of mission when we lost all of our hydraulics. And in the A-6, there's two systems, a combined and the flight hydraulic system. And then there's actually just a backup system. But we lost both the combined and the flight, and we were flying just on the backup system. And really, that just allows you to fly straight and level. Hmm. And we started rolling out of control and had a punch out.
Yeah, well, that sounds very dramatic, and I think we're going to have some questions about that coming up in a little bit. First, though, we're going to talk about some of the week's aviation news, and then we'll talk with Linda about some of the exciting things that she's done in her career, and also the exciting things that she's looking forward to. Then we've got Steve and Grant with their Australia Desk report. They've been off at another air show and made a recording from there, so we'll look forward to that. And then we've got Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. We also have, after that, a few Grill the Geeks questions, and then we'll finish up with some listener mail.
And again, after 1 week, I'm chopped liver.
Oh, I forgot, David. See, you're gone for a week, David, and it just slipped my mind. Of course, David will have his This Week in History Aviation segment, and that typically includes an aircraft of the week. Do we have one this time, David?
Yeah, I took a author's choice, and we're going to do the EA6A electric intruder on behalf of our guest.
Outstanding. Okay, we look forward to that. All right, well, why don't we get started? We've got a lot to do this episode, so why don't we get going with the news? Everyone ready?
Yeah!
First story comes from the Philadelphia NBC affiliate. This is Delta buys Delco Refinery. ConocoPhillips has been looking for a buyer for a refinery that's near Philadelphia. They're looking to either sell it or shut it down. Well, Delta says that it's going to buy the refinery for $150 million, and they figure this will save them maybe $300 million a year in its jet fuel bill. This is kind of different. I don't believe that airlines are typically in the business of buying or operating refineries.
Yeah, they're not. I'm here.
You're back.
But let's hear it for Delco, Pennsylvania. The local area is more than happy with this purchase.
Yes, and I think Pennsylvania was eager to help out because there was apparently $30 million in government assistance to help make this happen. But it's an interesting move because obviously, you know, we've talked about this for years now. Fuel prices are high for many airlines, depending on the fuel price. Now competing or sometimes even beating labor costs is the number one as the biggest cost for an airline. So, and there are a couple different pieces of the jet fuel price. Of course, usually the biggest part is the raw crude oil cost. And airlines try to hedge that financially, so they can do that by buying futures options, what have you, on things like crude oil futures for WTI or Brent crude. Some will buy options on some of the refined products. Like heating oil, there is no jet fuel contract in the U.S. at least. So anyway, for your jet fuel price, you have the raw crude oil price, but then you also have something called the crack spread, which is essentially the piece that the refiners get for cracking open the barrel of oil and refining it into different products. So it's basically a fancy way of referring to a gross profit margin for the refinery, for lack of a better term. So this move helps hedge the crack spread part, because now if Delta is taking the crude oil and refining it itself, it's really not getting, you know, they're kind of cutting out the middleman. So right now, this seems, from the numbers that Delta put out in their press release, this seems like a really good deal. They're purchasing the refinery for $150 million, and a subsidiary of Delta is acquiring it. And also spending an additional $100 million, not 150, to upgrade, or I guess the better term is convert the refinery to Delta saying to maximize the production of jet fuel, and Delta saying that they won't be able to produce just jet fuel with this oil, but with what jet fuel is produced at this refinery, and then plus they'll exchange some of the other products like gasoline for jet fuel. Delta saying this could cover about 80% of Delta's total fuel consumption in the U.S. So it can produce a good amount of jet fuel here. And Delta saying that, you know, $150 million to acquire, $100 million to upgrade. And they're saying this should provide $300 million a year in savings. So obviously that would be a relatively quick payback period. It's also a pretty big chunk of their total cost. I mean, just in 2011, Delta spent a little bit over $9.7 billion on fuel. So $300 million is a pretty good chunk of that. The only concern I have about it is one thing, that the crack spread is very volatile. It has been high, at least for WTI crude. So I'm not exactly sure what assumptions the crack spread going forward Delta is using to forecast these savings. The other thing right now this refinery isn't producing jet fuel.
Oh, it's not at all right now?
Yeah, and Yeah, basically, it's currently operated by ConocoPhillips, and to quote a story I found, ConocoPhillips idled the plant as rising imported crude oil costs, a collapse in demand, and tough competition from foreign refiners crushed margins. So, obviously, Delta isn't in this game like Conoco to try to maximize their profit, but that's a little bit of a red flag to me that, you know, Conoco, a big refiner, couldn't make this work, and now Delta's trying to do this vertical integration, and so that's the one thing. But if this does work, I mean, this is a pretty dramatic move, and if this the $300 million a year in annual savings do indeed materialize, it's really a fascinating move by Delta, and we'll just have to see how it turns out.
I've got a question for either David or Linda. Obviously, this is looking at it from a commercial aviation standpoint. In military aviation, do they care at all about cost of fuel? Is it a factor, or are there, you know, other issues that are bigger, more important, and so price of jet fuel is just not important? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I really think that it is an issue for the military with the defense spending cuts. The military overall looks at it in terms of cost per flight hour. So I'm sure that goes into it when they're figuring out the cost per flight hour, and also the maintenance numbers and the maintenance funding goes into that too. But I'm sure that's a big part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that makes sense. I was just curious to know. But it's an interesting venture for Delta. I hope that and assume that they're going to retain, you know, kind of the expertise, the refining expertise that they certainly don't have in house, and not try to, you know, run this without that. Otherwise, I can't see them being successful. But
they're keeping at least 400 local jobs in house that are with the transition. So it's a big deal for. It's kind of ironic the county I live in, because they're shuttering, Sunoco is shuttering several refineries in the area. So having a new one staying or reopening is a big deal for the economy of the county I actually live in. So I'm perfectly happy for my tax dollars to be going to Delta on this one.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And then also, in addition, just to the including the the refinery, in addition to that, to quote the press release, the acquisition includes pipelines and transportation assets that will provide access to the delivery network for jet fuel reaching Delta's operations throughout the Northeast, including its hubs at LaGuardia and JFK. So it's not just, so there's a little bit more than just the refinery, but, you know, like I said, big exciting move. I mean, I know when an airline story is big when I bump into professors at school who start asking me questions about why an airline is doing this. So when the general business professors start paying attention, it's a big deal.
You know, that's interesting. You know, I know we need to move on, but you know, if this deal also it means that Delta gets distribution, I wonder if that opens the possibility to in the future to biofuel distribution. I mean, that's one of the things we've talked about. One of the issues with biofuel, besides just, you know, the cost of it, but it's also the, you know, the need for a distribution method for it. Maybe this gives Delta an edge in that.
And one thing I'm not sure about is I believe, and I don't know about a lot of the different biofuels, but I remember one of the issues with ethanol back in the day when that was more of a thing here, is Delta ethanol cannot really go through a pipeline very well compared to oil. So I know it from the press release there are some pipelines involved. I don't know exactly how what the other biofuels that we're looking at, whether it's the algae based or anything else, how those move through pipelines. Well, I feel that has to be a really big issue for a biofuel to be successful, because obviously for a commodity like that, pipeline's the cheapest way to go usually.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Next story comes from the LA Times. It says some pilots refuse to fly F-22 Raptor amid jets' oxygen problems. So according to the article, there are about 200 F-22 pilots stationed at 7 military bases in the U.S. And the LA Times says that some of them won't fly the plane because of an oxygen system problem. David, maybe you could start us off by refreshing our memory on this particular problem.
The F-22 has a oxygen system that's a lot more sophisticated than we've had in the past. And it seems to want to push carbon monoxide into the oxygen mass of the pilots, causing them to suffer asphyxia and lose control of aircraft. And they're, normally it's oxygen survey. So basically they start blacking out in the midst of flying the F-22. Now, the Air Force can't figure out why the F-2 is suffering these problems and why these pilots are suffering these problems. They haven't, and in fact, we've actually, like this time last year, we had all the F-22s grounded. They've subsequently come back to flight status, and now eventually we've had a couple of other times where various squadrons have been down for a period of time for the same reason, but we still haven't, neither the Air Force nor Lockheed Martin has figured out the root cause of this asphyxiation problem causing us to lose at least one aircraft up in Alaska.
Hmm. Now, I'm not sure how many F-22 pilots have refused to fly because of this, but I mean, just in general, does that happen in the military? Is this unheard of, or is this something that happens maybe more frequently than we know?
I've never heard of that issue with other aircraft in the military. And just from my experience flying, if there's an issue like that that's so serious and the military downs those aircraft, it's kind of surprising that they'll bring them back up if the issue is not resolved. Hmm. And we all go through training. We go through hypoxia, how to know if you're becoming hypoxic. And it's a pretty serious issue. So it's very surprising that, you know, they brought those aircraft back up if there is still that problem. Hmm. But throughout my career, I've never experienced that.
In the military, what's the risk level? I mean, you know, in commercial aviation, we like to think that everything is just incredibly safe all the time. And that when there is an issue, it's, you know, it's because of unusual circumstances or, you know, something of that sort. But I'm curious, Linda, in the military, is it the same, or is flying military aircraft sort of inherently more risky and something that pilots accept? How does that compare to commercial flying?
Well, I mean, I think that's why, you know, most of your military pilots are young. I just thinking about my own ejection now, when I think about it, I'm more afraid of it than I was way back when in my 20s. And you're young, you're fearless, and you love what you do. It is inherently dangerous because you do train a lot. The military is the very best place, the very best environment, I think, for training. And so you are well prepared for any situation, but it is very inherently dangerous, especially flying off an aircraft carrier. Someone compared it once to an orchestra. Everyone on an aircraft carrier is just moving in, you know, everyone's doing their job. It's almost like they're moving in slow motion, everyone, but it's very dangerous. Hmm. But I think you just accept that, and because people want to serve their country, and it's very exciting too. At the same time, not only is it dangerous, but it's very exciting. You're flying at the tip of the spear, and but you just accept it.
Hey, Max.
Yes, David.
I decided that I'm getting sick and tired of people whining about the F-22. We've lost one. It's become the new tanker story. But I want to give some stats about an aircraft that is very, very famous, the F-104.
Okay.
Germany lost 30% of them with fatalities. Canada lost almost 50% of theirs with fatalities. And the Class A write-off for the Air Force by June of 77 was 26.7 accidents per 100,000 hours of flight time. Now, back in the 60s and 70s, you didn't hear everybody like the LA Times up in an uproar because F-104s were killing people left and right. The F-22 is a state-of-the-art aircraft. It's had one fatality and some problems. And if it wasn't for social media and it wasn't for the press being fixated on it, it's an aircraft that has had problems like any other modern jet fighter of its day. It's just right now it's easy for them to talk about because there aren't that many modern jet fighters anymore. But if you look at it overall in the scheme of the universe over military aviation over years, it's really a really good piece of machinery. So people really need to knock it off and start looking at it from a broader perspective instead of just, well, it's this week's news story because the press doesn't have anything else to talk about.
I completely agree with you. I have total confidence in the military. They are very safety conscious, and I don't think that they would let an aircraft fly if it was that severe, if there was such an issue. And I tend to agree about the whole social media and media in general. And I think if there maybe there were a ton of complaints, the military would definitely down that aircraft if there was an issue.
And as far as pilots not refusing to fly, the only pilot I ever knew that refused to engage was Tom Cruise in Top Gun.
Yeah, and he doesn't count, right?
And he doesn't count.
Okay. All right, good. Thanks for that perspective. That's good. Next story comes from The Telegraph. This is Air France Flight 447, quote, "Damn it, we're going to crash," unquote. And I want to thank listener Brendan, who sent us the link to this, as well as some comments on this article. And I think one other listener did as well. But this is a lengthy article about the June 2009 crash of Air France 447 in the Atlantic. The French accident report is due out in about a month, and the Telegraph is speculating that human error will be a factor. Let me just quote a few lines from the article. It says, "But there is another worrying implication that the Telegraph can disclose for the first time, that the errors committed by the pilot doing the flying were not corrected by his more experienced colleagues because they did not know he was behaving in a manner bound to induce a stall. And the reason for that fatal lack of awareness lies partly in the design of the control stick, the side stick, used in all Airbus cockpits." So maybe we start with Rob. Rob, you've been following this accident pretty closely from the beginning. What's kind of your assessment here?
I think that the Telegraph folks were trying to scoop the French BEA and sort of get the discussion going again, because I didn't honestly see anything in that story that I thought was eye opening. And I know one of our readers, Brendan, sent us a couple of questions, and he and I were, and yes, David and Brendan, David said I was being too hard on you. So, all right, if I didn't mean to be too hard on my comments, but the point was, is that, the side stick issue, for folks that don't know it, I mean, the A330 has a side stick controller on the left side of the cockpit for the captain and one on the right for the first officer. Would feedback in the sense that someone could notice the stick moving have helped? Personally, I don't think so, because the side sticks in the Airbus, even if they were moving, as they do with, say, a Boeing, where the wheel is in front of you, or even in, say, the fighters that Linda was flying, where you could see the stick moving between your legs, it's not the same thing. And so I don't think that the side sticks kind of pushed off to a corner of the cockpit in a sort of a shadowy spot, especially at night, would have made any impact on anybody. But also the amount of movement on a digital side stick is very, very small to get the airplane to move. And so, again, I don't think that's really the issue. But again, the fact that people are saying that the other pilot had no idea what was going on because they couldn't see the stick moving. Can we say bull? Well, I won't say that, but baloney. Yeah. All right. I mean, certainly there are issues, and this is what we were all having the discussion on an email before about pitch and power, and if you put the attitude in a certain position and you have the power set, the airplane should fly, unless in this particular case it was in a deep stall. It was so stalled, it was falling straight down, and there was no airflow across the wing. That's the one exception where that doesn't work. But again, that the other pilot had no idea at all, I don't buy that. I don't think they knew what to do, But I find it hard to believe that none of those three pilots, especially the captain, who had a lot of time in the 330, that none of them had any idea what was going on until the end. There's something else we're missing. I don't know what it is yet, but again, I think that the BEA report that comes out next month is probably going to say pilot error, because they pretty much planned that. They've set the stage for that. And so, again, I don't think we're going to see anything radical come into or come from that report next month. But again, the question we're still struggling with is why? Why did this happen? And it's more than just the pilots not realizing what was going on.
Yeah, oftentimes in these things, I think there are a number of contributing factors, you know, any one of which would not necessarily have, you know, caused the accident, but together in combination, they do. I don't know, Rob, do you have any feel for, do you think we'll be satisfied with the BEA report, or do you think it'll leave us unsatisfied, or you just don't know at this point?
I think we're all going to be, anyone that flies is going to be unsatisfied. I bet $11 on that, at least, maybe $12. But seriously, I think anybody that flies is going to be disappointed, because what they're going to say is it's pilot error, and these guys should have known. They should have been able to deal with this. And again, for those of us that weren't there that night, and I think that includes just about all of us, it's going to be very difficult to know precisely what was happening to them in that cockpit, because there's another cognitive issue that no one tends to want to talk about, which is how the human mind begins to overload when there's too much stimulation, and which parts of the emergency they were facing their brain simply refused to recognize. And so again, I think there's still more to the story, but I'm not expecting it in the BEA report.
Okay. Linda, another question for you, maybe out of my curiosity. When we see a commercial accident like this one and many others that we've seen, the investigation tends to be, you know, very detailed and lengthy, and, you know, there's a report in the end. And I was just curious to know what's the military equivalent when there's an accident, particularly one with loss of life. Is there an investigation to the same degree of depth that we see in the commercial world?
Oh, absolutely. And it's initially you're interviewed depending on if the aviators or the passengers live past the accident. In my own case, they immediately interviewed us and me and the other pilot, and to determine the cause of the accident. And initially, they tried to determine if it was pilot error. And if it was not pilot error, then they'll continue on in the investigation to determine the actual reason for the accident. But it is very detailed. And they also, if it is pilot error, then at some point they'll determine if you should continue flying, if you lose your wings, or if it was just something in the aircraft that happened. Like in my case, it was a total hydraulic failure, so it was not our issue. It was not our error, so we were able to continue flying. But yes, it's very detailed. It can go on for months, but a lot of it is not privy to the public either. And a lot of the details about military crashes are not, you know, open to the public.
Is there a military equivalent of the NTSB? Is there a group that specializes in these kinds of investigations?
There is. They have a safety group, a safety board, and depending on the severity of the accident and if it was pilot error or not pilot error, determines the outcome of the board. But there is a safety board. Within a squadron, they'll have the safety officer who will head up the investigation. If they need to, they'll bring in people from outside the squadron to conduct the investigation. And just like in a civilian accident, you're tested, you're taken to the hospital, you have to run a battery of tests, they take your blood, they you're there for several hours before you're released. They want to make sure you haven't been taking any substances, you haven't been drinking.
Sure.
So you get completely checked out.
All right, good. Before we move away from the news, I think, Rob, you had an article in Jetwine or a posting in Jetwine recently about user fees for general aviation. Maybe you could just spend a minute and kind of bring us up to speed on that.
Some people that listen to the show regularly may know, especially if you're involved in any of the politics of aviation, the White House, who has not shown themselves to be a real pal of aviation any more than the last president was, decided not long ago that a $100 per segment user fee was going to help them fund the next-gen air traffic control system. But, of course, what they're going to do is they're only going to push it on the airlines and business aviation. And I guess the point we made in the story at Jetwine that went up, well, it'll be up by the time this episode's out, is that if you believe that this is not going to come back and haunt us on the GA side, you're fooling yourselves. And I would encourage everyone to go back and listen to last week's episode in which Stephen Grant actually talked about the user fee structure that is in place down in Australia.
Right.
And it has just about killed general aviation in that country. And so what we did in this story on Jetwine is that we offered people a link. There's a link to the We the People page at the White House that says, hey, sign this petition and let's get the government, the feds, to explain to us why they're doing what they're doing and hopefully figure out a better way to solve the problem. And so, again, we need 25,000 signatures. I don't know what we have right now. I think 4,000 or 5,000. But it only takes a second. You know, pass it around, sign the petition, and do something good for the entire aviation industry. Because, again, even though it doesn't affect anyone except business aviation and the airlines right now, they'll be coming after us next.
Again, our guest this episode is Linda Maloney. Linda, again, thanks for coming on the show.
And thanks for having me.
You know, there's a lot of things we'd like to talk to you about, but maybe we could spend just a minute. We have to talk about your ejection seat adventure. What's it like? I mean, is this a sort of thing like maybe parachuting where, you know, the first time you're scared to death, but after you jump out of an airplane with a parachute, you get down to the ground and you say, wow, that was pretty cool, and you'd like to do it again. Is an ejection seat ride anything like that?
Well, you do train. You don't eject out of an aircraft training for it, but you do go through a series of training events. And you actually do parasailing. When I was in Navy flight school, we actually did parasailing to simulate what it would be like to hang in a parachute. And you go through all the aviation swimming. And so you're very prepared for it. But when it does happen, it's an absolute surprise in a lot of ways. I mean, you go through your, when you have an emergency in the aircraft, you go through a series of procedures, emergency procedures, and it all is just second nature because you practice it all the time. And, but I remember my own ejection, at the moment that you had to eject, you did it, but it was a very shocking experience. And I remember riding up the rails in the A6. We actually bust through the canopy, and there are yellow papers flying everywhere because of my knee board. And I blacked out for about, I don't know, 5-10 seconds. But everything happens in very slow motion. And I don't think you're afraid when it's happening. And like I said earlier, when I look back on it, it's more scary than it was back then. And I remember after I blacked out, I came to and I was in the tug of the parachute and I just went through all my procedures. Inflated my raft below me because I was over the ocean. And I just went through all the different procedures. And right before I hit the water, I released the Koch fittings of my parachute and then climbed into my raft and then waited for for rescue. And so I know, you know, it is very dangerous, but you're trained, you know, very well in the military.
During that, are you aware of what's happening to the you know, the other guy that was in the plane? Do you know what's going on with him?
Well, in that version of the A6, we did not have an automatic ejection, in terms of we had to pull our own handle. And so I pulled my handle first, and then he pulled his. And so I did not know if he was okay. And the guys that handled all the emergency equipment in the squadron were the guys that worked for me. I was their division officer. And so I laughed later on because I checked my radio every single day before I went flying. But that day we were in a hurry and I didn't check my radio. And when I got into my raft, my radio was dead. And that was the first time I did not check it. So I couldn't even call anyone. I couldn't check with the other guy. Stan Parsons was his name. He and I still keep in touch with each other. The ejection was back in 1991. And every year on February 11th, we always send each other an email and say happy anniversary.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
Right. And we both were picked up by separate helicopters. And another really cool story is the rescue swimmer who rescued me. His name was AT2 Stephen Wishoff. And he came over to me in the water. He didn't realize I was a woman. And he asked me if I was okay. And I said, I'm fine. He said, oh, you're a girl. And I said, yeah, I am. And but he just connected with me on Facebook. He found me on Facebook, and I sent him a copy of my book. Oh, so that was kind of cool. That just happened a couple weeks ago.
That's amazing.
Hey, Linda, you know, I have a question. After you've experienced an ejection like that, does the Navy have some sort of a, you know, maybe a bit of a tongue-in-cheek kind of I've ejected from an airplane club or something? Or does everybody ejected at some point know about that?
Well, the Navy doesn't per se, but depending on the type of ejection seat, my ejection seat was the Martin Baker seat, and it was from a British company, and I was their first woman, so it was a big deal. But they hand out ties. They give Martin Baker ties to all ejectees. And at around the same time was the 6,000 crew that ejected. They actually ejected from a Prowler. And so this was, I think it was during the Gulf War. It was back in 1991. And so they called me a couple weeks after my ejection to ask me for the details, because I was definitely at the lower end of the weight limit for the seat. And so they wanted to find out how the seat performed and what type of injuries that I had. And they also asked me if I wanted a tie. And I said, hey, just send me whatever you'd like. And they ended up designing this little pewter pin that I still have for their first female ejecting me. And they also had a big celebration about 6 months later that they invited me to. But before that, they invited me to come over to England to accept the pewter pin from the Princess of Wales, Princess Diana. But the military would not allow me to go. I don't know why. I was very disappointed I could not go. So Martin Baker had a big gala event down in D.C. I think it was at the Willard Hotel in October of 1991. And they invited me, and they also invited the 6,000 crew, the Prowler crew. And so it was a very special event. I still have pictures from it, and I keep in touch with them. They have my story on their website.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. The thing that amazed me the most, I think, was that there were 6,000 ejections in that seat, in that manufacturer's seat, you know, prior to you. And I had no idea that there were that many ejections.
Well, there's probably a lot more since then. That was back in 1991, so there probably are many more since then.
Yeah, that's amazing. I want to get to the book that you've written, put together, but to sort of set the stage for that, I thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, I've learned quite a bit, actually, in the last few weeks, kind of looking into this. But I guess I sort of knew that there had been a ban on women in combat missions, and I didn't realize that that had gone back to, what, this National Security Act of 1947?
Right. And the combat exclusion law actually was not repealed until 1993. But for years before that, the Dakowitz Commission, Defense Advisory Commission on Women in the Military Service had been lobbying Congress to get the law repealed. Women actually started flying in the military after the WASP in 1973. And my book is actually dedicated to the Navy's very first female pilot in the Navy. She was in the very first class. I think there were seven originally. The Navy was the first to start allowing military women pilots. And the book is dedicated to Barbara Allen Rainey, who ended up dying in a Navy training accident. But yes, the combat exclusion law was finally repealed in 1993, and that allowed women in the military service to start flying in combat squadrons. So that was a very exciting day. The anniversary was just last week of the repeal of that law.
Max, can I dovetail off that?
Yeah, David, go ahead.
Linda, what was it like to fly with VAQ-33? That seemed to be the original mixing pot for women in naval aviation. There seemed to be so many women that eventually in 93 went to the fleet squadrons, but VAQ-33 seemed to be the hotbed for women aviators, at least in the early 90s.
Right. Well, before 1993, and like I said earlier, women could only fly in support squadrons. And I always laugh because the big thing was they did not want women flying in combat because they didn't want women to be taken as prisoners of war or women coming home in body bags. And there was this big fear. But I always laugh and say, well, they let us fly the oldest airplanes in the Navy in the inventory. I mean, the EA-6As, you know, were some of the oldest airplanes that the Navy flew. But there were two primary support squadrons, and what the support squadrons did was train fleet aviators and also ships on what enemy tactics look like. Like, we would simulate missiles, we would simulate enemy radars, and that was our primary mission. There were two squadrons. There was VAQ-33 in Key West, and there was VAQ-34 in Point Magoo, California. And that's where the bulk of the women aviators were. It was very interesting squadrons because the guys in the squadron were guys that didn't quite cut the mustard in the fleet. So that's where they went. So you had these really aggressive, go-getter women that really wanted to be flying in combat. And then you had these other guys who were great guys. I mean, all in all, they were wonderful guys, and they were great mentors, a lot of them. But just created a very interesting squadron.
Now, the book, Military Fly Moms, is, I think, kind of fascinating because what you've done is assembled a collection of, 70 female military aviators and mothers who tell their stories in their own words, right?
Right. I started the book back in, after I retired. I retired from the Navy in 2004. And that was the year I actually had my first son. And my husband really wanted me to write a book. He really encouraged me to write a book. But I just thought that my story was just one of very many women. And I just got this idea about starting a book, a coffee table style book, highlighting stories and photographs of women from all military services. And it took me 8 years because all the women... very busy women, they're deploying, having kids. And so it just took us 8 years to finally put the book together. And it's a collection of stories from women from every military service, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marine Corps, Air National Guard. And the women are at all different various stages of their career. They probably range in age from 30 to about 55. And some are staying home moms now, some are active duty, some are retired, some are reservists, just all very different stages of life. And the book just tells their story, you know, what motivated them when they were growing up to join the military and to fly, who were their mentors, who inspired them. It talks about flight school and flying in combat, and then what it's like to be a mom in that environment. And the type of support and family life work decisions that have to be made to make it all work. And sometimes it doesn't work. So their stories talk about the decisions they have to make. They and their spouse, most of the women, are married. There are a couple that are single moms, but mostly they're married. And a lot of them are dual military couples. And so they're just really great stories. And the stories also talk about the legacy that they want to pass down to their children and the encouragement that they give to other women if they're interested in flying or flying in the military. Just a really great group of women. I started out with about 200 women, and then I pared it down to 70, 71, including myself.
Yeah, it must have been tough to pare it down.
Were there one or two that just kind of stood out in your mind as people that just made you stand back and say, wow, more than the others, I guess?
They're all really great women. I just can't. Even now, I know their stories. The stories are in first person, and I wrote a lot of the stories for the women, and then they massaged them to make it more their own. But a lot of the women wrote their own stories also, so it's a collection. But the women are just so competent and very smart, motivated, dedicated, just a great group of women. There are I can't really pick out one or two because there's so many great stories. And like I said, I've read them many, many times, and I still can sit down and read the book and still really enjoy all the stories.
And that's what I've been doing, Linda. And they really are wonderful stories. And I also like some of the sort of the short quotes or vignettes in the back of the book. One thing that seems to characterize these women in general is really a high degree of self-confidence. I mean, it's not always, you know, easy, but just by way of an example, maybe I can just read her a quote. This is from Lori Rasmussen, and I think this is sort of, it sort of says a lot. She says, "I was the only female in my flight and the designated flight commander of about 15 fellow pilots and 15 students. I had just had my first child when I returned to flight status, still nursing. I had to stand up in front of all the guys on my first day back and announce, 'This little black briefcase is a breast pump. Are there any questions?' All I got was 30 red-faced men staring back at me with nothing to say. It was hysterical and so fun to make those grown men blush." So, I mean, some of the stories are just, you know, you read them and you think, wow, I can just imagine that. It's been a challenge for a lot of these women, I think.
Right, right. And a lot of times they are one of the only women in their squadron. And, yeah, there's just a lot of great stories like that. A lot of breast pump stories in the book. So.
Now, you've got a lot of interest, I think, in helping young folks, young women, but also just young folks in general with getting a start into aviation. And in fact, part of the proceeds of this book you're donating.
Right, I am. I teamed with Linda Meeks from Girls with Wings. Linda and I have known each other probably for about 8 years. And when I was putting the book together, I wanted to come up with a cause, an organization that I could help with the portion of the profits of the book. And Girls with Wings is the organization. And they do such a really fabulous job of educating society in general about aviation and women in aviation and encouraging young girls to get involved in aviation. Linda travels throughout the country along with a volunteer group of other women putting on different presentations for young girls, encouraging them, even if they're not interested in aviation, just to encourage them to go after their dreams and to pursue their passions and also to stay involved in school and stay motivated and stay involved with math and science, and just a really awesome organization. I'm very proud to be teamed with Linda and Girls with Wings.
Yeah, that's great. We've had Linda Meeks on previously as a guest on this podcast, and that was great to have her on. It really, she's doing a great job, doing a good work and doing it well. David, is there some naval aviation question that you have burning that you'd like to ask?
I want to know what it's like pretending you're a cruise missile attacking the Forrestal.
Well, you get to fly low and slow or low and fast over the water. So that part of it is really exciting, especially at night if you're doing that. So you really have to be obviously very aware of where you are and your altitude and your speed.
So I didn't get that previously. So it's not like you're electronically well, maybe you are simulating a cruise missile. You're physically acting like a cruise missile. Is that right?
Both. We would have pods on the aircraft that would simulate certain radars and certain missiles, and we also would fly certain profiles.
Wow.
She got to fly.
It wasn't that exciting, though, believe it or not. It really was. When the combat exclusion law changed and we were able to go to regular, quote-unquote, squadrons, we were ecstatic. And there were a group of us that were on the aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln. It was the West Coast aircraft carrier. It was the first West Coast boat that women were on. And so we all were very excited to be there.
Hmm.
I don't know if you guys know, but I don't know if you've read this in my story, but Kara Hulgreen, Lieutenant Kara Hulgreen, she was an F-14 pilot. She was the very first F-14 pilot. She was on the USS Abraham Lincoln, a good friend of mine. She and I flew A-6s together in Key West. And I was on the boat the day that she died. I don't know if you know much about her accident, but she died coming aboard the boat in F-14. Mm. And that was a very tumultuous time for a lot of people in military aviation, but that happened on the Lincoln, and there was a lot of questioning
about.
How
many years ago was that? That was about.
That was 1990.
I'm thinking of a different. Wasn't there another one where a lady ejected or was killed in a fighter 5 or 6 years ago? Or am I?
Well, Revlon or Hulk, depending upon who you were talking to, where it's coming aboard the Abraham Lincoln and came aboard too slow, and the aircraft went off the edge of the boat and flamed out both engines, causing her to die. Unfortunately, they ruled it as pilot error. But yeah, it was her call sign was Hulk up until she did a interview, because she was the first female Tomcat pilot. All the guys on the boat, because they saw her wearing makeup for the interview, started calling her Revlon, which caused all sorts of discrimination afterwards, because the Navy was, then all of a sudden the sexist comments came out, and it really wasn't had anything to do with it. So Linda, based on call signs, you have enough guts to tell us what yours was?
I had a couple different ones. My last one that I had was Raw, because my maiden name was Hyde. And I spent a lot of time in the tanning bed, so they would always call me Raw. But back to the thing on Kara, I actually was on the boat the day that she died and watched it happen. I was in my squadron, and I was the squadron duty officer. I was in the ready room and actually saw her boat, her aircraft come aboard the boat and saw it happen. I actually did her eulogy a couple of days after the accident. It was just a very sad time.
Mm. Yeah, it's got to be tough.
And Linda, what was significant about the aircraft she was flying?
What do you mean by that?
The aircraft she was flying was one of the Sukhoi downers. The sister aircraft is now at the National Air and Space Museum. But that actually was, I'm not sure if it was, if not sure if the aircraft was actually one of the F-23, the MiG-23 ones, but I'm pretty sure she was one of the VF-41 shoot down birds for the Sukhois over Libya.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
David knows a lot. All right. Well, Linda, maybe you can tell our listeners where they can find out more about you online and where they can find the book.
My website is www.lindahydemaloney.com.
Did we lose Linda? Uh-oh.
Should get Max back on here soon. Actually, but you know, Linda, something I know what I was going to ask you before when I couldn't remember. Everyone says that a lot of ladies that either do or do not go into aviation have a love-hate relationship with science and math. I mean, were you one of these girls as you grew up that was really astounding at science and math from the get-go, or did you ever have trouble with it?
I think I'm of average intelligence. I mean, I think I'm smart, but I don't think I'm like, over the top with math and science. I was always very good at math. But I always tell people that I think being smart is just part of it. I think being dedicated and really wanting to do it, if it's your passion, I think that's another big part of it. And I'm trying to think of other women that I've talked to about that, about the math and science part. There's a lot of people in the military, in military aviation, that have English degrees. So I do think, you know, you have to be smart, but I also think being motivated and dedicated and also having a passion for it is really such a big part of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And I also loved aviation. I don't know if I mentioned to you before, but I initially enlisted in the military when I was 17 and didn't want to go to college right away, or actually just didn't have the funds to go to college. And I enlisted in the military. I loved aviation. My mom was a reservation and airline, an airline reservation and ticket agent. And so I grew up around aviation, and I just remember having a love of airports growing up. And so I went into the military as an air traffic controller initially. And then I got picked up for a scholarship, a ROTC scholarship, after I'd been in the Navy for a couple of years. And so I went to college on the Navy's dime and got my commission that way and came back in and then went to flight school.
Oh, that's really interesting that you were a Navy controller. I was an Air Force controller for a long time. And of course, you as a controller were probably on a boat, right?
I was not, because that was back in the early 80s. And again,
that would have been combat, Rob.
That's right.
Oh, that's right.
I was in Hawaii. I was stationed in Hawaii, and I was a controller there.
Did you do GCA approaches?
I was a center controller, more of a center. Right. Yeah. I only did it for a couple years. I actually started college by the time I was 21. So I had 3.5 years of enlisted time.
We still don't have a Max. I tried to call him, and I can't get him back.
But that's good, because at least we're still recording this.
Well, that's true. So, let's see. I think we had ended with Max asking you, Linda, how people could find you. And I think that part got recorded. But, Linda, what about people that want to buy your book?
They can either go to my website to buy the book. It's www.lindaheidmaloney.com, or they can also buy it via Amazon or my publisher's website. My publisher is tannenbaumpublishing.com. However, if they go to my website, there is a promotional code there that they can enter at my publisher's website and get $10 off the retail price. So that's actually the better deal.
Ooh, cool. Well, let's see. Anything else we should talk about, David? You know more about this, you know, this military
stuff. I want to know, when she's riding in a prowler, she was in the front or the back?
Both. Like I said earlier, I was a right seater or a back seater, depending on what aircraft you're in. And in the prowler, it's if you're not the pilot, you're called an ECMO, electronic countermeasure officer. And so that was my role. And depending on the number in your crew, you would rotate your positions. And up front and the right, you primarily would handle the radios, the radar, the HARM missile, and the communications. And in the back seat, you would primarily handle all the electronic countermeasures.
Okay. The next follow-on question was, did you ever get to fire a HARM?
I did not, unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately, as you would see fit. I did fly over in Desert Storm on Westpac 95, and we flew missions over Iraq, but we did not shoot any HARM missiles at that time.
I got to get this book.
It really is a great book. I'm not a very good salesperson. I could never take a job selling anything, but I can sell the book. It's just a really great collection of stories, and it's not just for women, it's for men too. And the pictures are wonderful. There's 75 photographs. Most of them are color in the book, and just a different collection of photographs, some of them with the women in uniform, some with their aircraft, some with their families.
I guess we'd like to thank Linda for being on the show and hope she'll come back again when she finishes her next book.
Oh, I would love to. I already have another idea in mind, starting my next book. So it's actually a book for young kids.
What's the topic going to be?
Well, I have young children, and they buy books from Scholastic book fairs all the time.
Oh, sure. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I saw a book just recently that I bought for myself, not even for my son, that was talking about the military serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was really for a child's perspective, for their understanding. And so I just got this great idea to do an aviation book for kids that talked about all the different military services and the different aircraft that you could fly. And they have different terms in there. But it's really geared to like an 8 to 10-year-old. So that's my next idea. That's my next project.
Oh, cool. Well, I wish you a lot of luck
pictures
with that.
And, thank you.
Since we kind of lost Max here, I'm not
I guess he's back.
Oh, he's back.
I'm back. Oh. I'm back. you just missed about 15 minutes of great content that I all recorded to save your butt.
Well, good. I lost the internet for some reason. And now, here's David Vanderhoof.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode Number 16, May 6th through the 12th. May 6th, 1896. One from the Grant McCarran, they flew before the Wrights files. Well, wait a minute. We can't really qualify this because there's actually a photograph. Samuel P. Langley flew with steam-powered aerodrome number 5 off of a catapult in the Potomac River. The catapult was built on top of a houseboat. The number 5 was unmanned and it flew almost 3/4 of a mile before crashing into the river. The number 5 flew farther than any previously heavier-than-air machines. Two actual flights were made that day. Langley would continue his experiments with his aerodromes until his failures with the manned versions in 1903. May 6, 1937. 75 years ago today, the LZ-129, a German passenger airship, was on final approach to Naval Air Station Lakehurst. It had 97 people aboard, 36 who had booked passage from Germany to the United States, only one half of the intended passenger load. The flight's arrival was delayed by thunderstorms. The delay had caused a flight over Manhattan, which had stopped the city for a glimpse of the enormous airship. At 7 p.m. local time, the airship started its descent to the mooring tower at Lakehurst. The ship would drop its lines and would be winched into the mast instead of flying into it. After several attempts at 7:25, a puff of gas appeared. Within seconds, the greatest airship, the Hindenburg, burst into flames and started to crash. Within 34 seconds, the great ship was lost, ending the era of airship transportation. One ground crew and 35 others, passengers and crew, were lost. The newsreel footage with Herbert Morrison's it's crashing, oh, the humanity, will forever be linked to that evening 75 years ago. The Airplane Geeks Aircraft of the Week. Again, I am taking liberties because we have a guest who actually flew in this aircraft. The EA-6A Electric Intruder. In honor of our guest, I am changing the topic again. Tonight we're going to talk about a Grumman aircraft most people don't know about, the EA-6A. Before there was the Growler, there was the Prowler, and before that was the Electric Intruder. The A2F-1H was an outgrowth of the successful A2F-1, later to be known as the A6A Intruder. First flown on April 26, 1963, the all-weather attack aircraft was a perfect for an electronic countermeasures aircraft. The U.S. Marine Corps requested an ECM platform that could take the electrons with the attackers. The side-by seating was perfect for an air-to-air ECM platform. Three external differences between the EA-6A and the A6A are clearly visible. The first was an 8-inch plug added in front of the nose behind the radome. This was accommodate additional antennas specifically for the ECM role. This also makes the EA-6A look a little more streamlined than its tadpole-shaped attack brethren. The A6A used wingtips speed brakes. On the EA-6A, these were deleted for two reasons. One, they were afraid they would cause severe buffeting since the EA-6A received an additional outer wing hardpoint. Secondly, it was to be a land-based aircraft for the United States Marine Corps, and they determined that they weren't necessary. The third most important difference was the tail. The ALQ-86 receiver surveillance system required a football-shaped flaring on top of the tail. This would carry over into the two follow-on aircraft, the EA-6B Prowler and the EA EF-111A Sparkvark. Sorry, I'm never going to call that the Raven. It was also the successes of the EA-6A that led the Air Force to decide that it only needed a two-person flight crew instead of the four of the EA-6B. The strengthened wing of the A-6 had another advantage. The EA-6 could carry a variety of fuel tanks and pods. An additional set of pylons were added outside the wing fold. Early versions had a large hoop antennas out on the wingtip. Eventually, it would carry pods to simulate various threats for training. The A-6A could also carry the AGM-45 Shrike anti-radiation missile, though I have no documentation that this was actually carried in combat. The United States Marine Corps took the version into the hostile environment of Vietnam. VMCJ-1, the Playboys, flew out of Da Nang Air Base. The aircraft would fly with other Navy and Marine A-6As on alpha strikes against North Vietnam targets. One aircraft would jam for a flight of attack aircraft. Later in the war, VMCJ-1 would also acquire RF-4B Phantoms. The combined squadron recon flights would be escorted by the electronic intruder. Lastly, operating from Japan, EA-6A supported the B-52s during Operation Linebacker. The lessons learned by the EA-6A in Vietnam would contribute to the successes of the EF-111As and the EA-6Bs in Desert Storm. Eventually, five Marine Corps squadrons would fly the EA-6A, VMCJ-1, 2, and 3, followed by VMAQ-2 and 4. By 1979, the United States Marine Corps Reserve Unit, VMAQ-4, was flying the aircraft. All other squadrons had acquired the larger replacement, the Prowler. The aircraft were transferred to Naval Reserve Squadrons VAQ-209 and VAQ-309, 309 on the West Coast, 209 on the East. One active duty squadron, the VAQ-33 Firebirds, also took on some aircraft. VAQ-33 in Key West, it was a training squadron and one of the first integrated squadrons. Back in 1991, when our guest Linda was flying for the Navy, women weren't allowed to fly in combat. They could only fly support missions. Flying as an electronic adversary was considered one of those missions. Many flights were considered unmanned with complete female crews. A composite squadron, VAQ-33, would fly the EA-7Ls, EA-6As, EC-121 Warning Stars, EAK-3D Whales, EF-4Js, and EA-4Fs. Fleet Electronic Warfare Support Squadron was disbanded on October 1st, 1993 for budget cuts. The role of electronic aggressors is currently filled by civilian contractors. Grumman Aircraft only made 27 EA-6As. 12 were rebuilt from A-6As. The other 15 were straight new builds. The aircraft was extremely successful and the unsung hero of modern electronic warfare. It brought jamming to the forefront. The successes of both the EF-111A and the EA-6B are directly related. It may have been the transition aircraft, but it did provide two important leaping points. One is the father of modern electronic jamming aircraft, and two, the aircraft that opened the doors to women flying full combat missions in the United States Navy. So for next week, we'll run the randomizer, and the winner is... one of the first jet airliners, the Sud Aviation Caravelle. And that's the way it was, May 6th through May 12th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wait a minute. I have to ask a question, David. Are you seriously telling me that when ladies were flying some of those missions, they actually called them unmanned and no one thought that was a joke? I mean, or was that some kind of Navy humor? Unmanned? I mean... That sounds like the kind of thing I'd say.
I have a book on Key West by Osprey Publications that probably has two of Linda's cohorts, and they talk about their flight in a very rough flight in a Corsair II, an EA-7L, and it was a two-woman crew, and they call it unmanned.
It makes sense. Does that make sense to you, Linda?
It was a joke back then. It still is a joke now. Some of the women, if they have a completely female crew, they'll laugh about calling it unmanned flight.
I think that's great.
The women love it. It's kind of a joke.
So Linda, how did David do? Did he get it right?
He was right on. I know. I was like, wow, that was great. You did all your research. Very good.
That's our David.
didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, May 6, 2012.
Well, it's noisy around here. Grant, there must be an air show going on.
Oh, I think so. I've just seen a big old constellation do a beat up of the strip, so I think we're in the middle of something really cool.
Yes, in fact, here we are for episode 196 of the Airplane Geeks for the Australia Desk, and we're at Wings Over the Illawarra Air Show here in New South Wales. Beautiful day here. We're a little bit worried about the weather coming up after the 300-hour drive, Grant, that we had coming up here. But
that was a bit full-on trying to get ourselves here, but we packed you and I and Alan into the PCDU mobile, and we did the road trip. We came on up. It was absolutely wonderful. And as you can hear in the background, we've got another piece of aviation happening. One of the helicopters that's doing rides just near the hangar we're based in is coming in to land.
Yeah, now I tell you what, Grant, sitting here at this air show makes me think, I've long been thinking about perhaps buying an aircraft, and maybe we should start an airline. And I think just to keep it as an Australian theme, I'm thinking we should name it after some sort of animal. I think that's a real winner of an idea. What do you reckon?
Steve, I think you're crazy. You're obviously not keeping up with current trends and not looking at the new CASA operating manual that they haven't published but are clearly working to, because any airline with an animal name in it is obviously cowering in fear at the moment. We've had Tiger Airways get grounded, and we've also had just yesterday Alligator Airways was grounded.
Alligator Airways. Now, I must admit, Grant, I'd never heard of Alligator Airways until this came up, but they've been grounded. They do scenic flights on tours up around the Kimberley region in Western Australia, amongst other things.
Yeah, that's right. They had a few show cause notices from CASA, indications that CASA was not happy with what they were doing. And the latest was that after a few incidents that they believe that indicated that staff were flying aircraft that maybe they shouldn't have been, they weren't properly maintained. So they've grounded the whole airline, which it's kind of interesting. CASA's trying to show that they're tough and they're taking action. And yet we've had quite a number of instances recently where Jetstar pilots and first officers have caused some concern, and yet Jetstar is still flying, so we're not sure what's going on there.
Yeah, well, I think obviously what's going on is that Jetstar is not named after an animal, so that's obviously the theme going on here.
Yeah, I think what you need to do is change the name of your airline. Have a think about it while we report on a few other things, and let's see if you can come up with a better non-animalistic name.
The Civil Aviation Authority granted them initially for 5 days, he says, as the Connie flies past again, but they're going to the federal court to apply for an extension of the granting, so obviously some serious issues going on there for Alligator Airways. And let's hope they get those sorted out, and we can get them back in the air if that's the appropriate thing to do.
Mate, if it's anything like most airlines and aviation businesses are run, a couple of days grounded can make a big difference, and if they're grounded for more than a week or so, they may never come back.
Well, speaking of people that are grounded, I think a lot of Qantas jobs are about to be grounded. Grant, a lot of bad news has come out from Qantas this week on the jobs front. In fact, it looks like several hundred jobs are going predominantly in maintenance and predominantly in Melbourne.
That's right. The reports are that they're considering axing 400 jobs at their Tullamarine maintenance base. Really not good there. There's a lot of maintenance on 737s done in Melbourne, and they're looking at getting rid of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Qantas have been trying to shut that Melbourne maintenance base down for a long time. Their contention is that the new aircraft, predominantly the A380s, Qantas management claim that they don't require as much maintenance, therefore there's not the work for them here, and they seem to be putting the case across that, well, they don't want to invest the money in training the local maintenance technicians when they can send him across to places like Lufthansa Technik over there in Europe and perhaps get them serviced over there.
Well, more like Lufthansa Technik in Singapore. They've got a very large base there. It's a lot closer than Europe. So they're definitely doing a lot of their maintenance offshore, more and more of it. And there's some minor issues that are cleared up by the new technology, but there's still a lot of maintenance required. I know that it just shifts to a lot more computer technician rather than wielding a spanner.
Now, I'll tell you what, though. I mean, at the base level, they still do have to wield the spanners. They've got to get somebody out there and get their hands on the machinery at some point. It's disappointing that they can't see an opportunity here in this part of the world to perhaps retool those workshops at Melbourne and at Avalon. The only good news, I guess, out of these announcements or pending announcements is they're looking at perhaps increasing their maintenance presence in Brisbane. So maybe some of those jobs might be able to go up there.
Yeah, there are requests about consolidation going on, and we'll see what happens there. But one of the other things that's happening in Qantas is that they've deferred delivery of two of the A380s They're arranging a cut of about $400 million in their capital expenditure because of their apparently struggling international airline, which is interesting because international passengers are up at the moment, but we won't go there. That gets in the way of what they're talking about.
Yeah, interesting. And also, Grant, one of the things they have noticed, I guess, on a good news front is that they're talking about increasing their capacity on their domestic routes up and down the East Coast. That's good. I mean, you know, that's good for Qantas staff and good for passengers, and an obvious response to Virgin's recent announcement.
Exactly. That is entirely what they're doing. It is a complete reaction to Virgin increasing their number of seats available. They're putting on more A330s. They're going to have the A330s not just on the Transcontinental, but also on the Golden Triangle, as we discussed previously. And what you're looking at there is Qantas's reaction. We're going to see more capacity. We're going to see fares coming down. There's going to be a bit of a war. We'll see who wins.
Well, speaking of things that won't be going to war anytime soon, Australia's F-35. Sorry, David, we have to talk about the F-35. Australia has pushed back its purchase date by at least another 2 years on the F-35s.
Well, what they're doing is pushing back the decision date on the next batch of F-35s. They've already committed to buying two. They're due to be delivered in the next couple of years. They will be based in the US, used for testing and training purposes. I doubt we'll ever see those aircraft back here in Australia in any hurry. But they've pushed back till 2014, I believe it is, when they're going to make their decision on the next batch of 12.
Air Defence Minister Stephen Smith said that the government is now even perhaps considering buying a further 12 F/A-18F and F Super Hornets and going through another life extension program for the classic Hornets, the F/A-18 A's and B's, which, Grant, as the article here in AustralianAviation.com.au points out, are coming up on 30 years old, those airframes.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely getting on. And the centre, the Hornet centre barrel upgrades, the HUG, the Hornet Upgrade Project, there's a lot of people who consider that they're just pushing it too hard, that they should let those aircraft go and just get more supers and nothing else. I'm really not sure what the answer is here. But, you know, one of the things I've got to ask about it is the F-35. Is there any plans to make that into a tanker?
I can hear David squealing from here in despair, Grant, as you say that.
There you go, mate.
Well, I think we might wrap it up here. We're going to have a busy day here at the Wings Over Illawarra Air Show. That's a mouthful, Grant. They need to change the name of that.
Yeah, I know. But speaking of names, have you come up with a name for your new airline?
Yeah, no, I haven't actually. I might call it, I don't know, Pussycat Airlines. No, we can't.
No,
call it.
Still got a name in there with it. Mate, you're going to have to go for a name that doesn't have an animal. How about Kludge Air?
Mate, I can't even afford to buy a Cessna, so my chances of buying an airline are pretty slim, I'd say.
Oh, looks like Ben Air is still safe then.
There you go. Folks, if you want to know what we've been up to, you can check that out at woi.org.au. We've got the mobile studio set up here, and you can check out some photos. I'm sure we'll have plenty of photos from the day by the time this episode comes out.
No doubt, mate. Wings Over Illawarra, one of the biggest air shows in this part of Sydney and Australia. Absolutely fantastic collection of aircraft here from the Historical Aircraft Restoration Society, including the Super Constellation, a Catalina, a DC-3, a DHA Drover, and a number of other aircraft. Plus, we've also got jets. We've got some military presence. It's a fantastic blue skies day.
Yes, and the RAF have brought down a C-130 Hercules, and I'm eyeing that off, mate. I'm thinking meteor ride. We need to get out there.
Well, that's your kind of ride, mate.
Absolutely. Well, getting my recorder ready and my grovelling pad so I can go and talk to the RAF crew. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm not Steve Vischer.
That's right. He's Grant McCarron. Cheers, folks.
And now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
We've just finished talking to Tim Gresty at Cognitio, the consultancy based in the UK, and it was such a fascinating discussion that we had. Tim continued to tell us a little bit about his views, how the industry would evolve in terms of the low-cost carriers and the main carriers. And I decided to take some of those comments that Tim made and put them into a program that I think shows some really interesting views and experience of how the sector is working in UK and Europe, and in fact worldwide.
Point one was low cost will become more traditional, like EasyJet with seat reservations, business travelers a lot. But Air Berlin is a much better example, and actually Ryanair claim they're the biggest in Europe. They might be in passenger numbers, but Air Berlin is bigger in revenue, and that to me is what matters. We forget that they're all businesses rather than airlines, and I think if you look at the structure of Air Berlin and EasyJet, they're looking to the outside funding, like the 29% of Air Berlin owned by Etihad, the fact that the new chairman of EasyJet is a man who, with KPMG, ran their Middle East operation, is used to introducing investment, etc. Yeah. And I think that's the way the low-cost airlines are going to be sorted out. Not O'Leary's bloodbath for passengers, but a proper structure financially for those airlines. And that's another fascinating subject. I mentioned investment. I mentioned consolidation. In fact, BMI and BMI Regional at the moment, that is going to be fascinating because, of course, BA got rid of their regional operation and it's in a mess. You know, let's be fair. Our friends at Flybe have got a problem on their hands. No one wants to buy it. And the Walker Family Trust want out. The Walker Family Trust have been trying to sell that airline now for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah,
probably more. And when you look at their operation there, you look at Jim French, has been working very, very hard to get out because the Walker family, really, their trust, it's been on the market for a long time. And the same applies when you bring in our friends BMI Regional. What's going to happen? Remember, BMI Regional attracted a negative premium from Lufthansa.
Yeah.
Lufthansa made British Airways take it over by reducing the price where they included BMI Regional. And the other area I think that may be interesting is what I call intelligent air travelers. Well, intelligent air travelers, the low-cost airline sector has boomed particularly because of inexperienced travelers. For example, I had an EasyJet flight out of Geneva a few months ago. Last flight of the day was cancelled because the plane went technical. Most of the passengers panicked, started shouting, grabbed bits. Some went off into town booking hotels, the lot.
Yeah.
The experienced ones sat back, talked to EasyJet, got ourselves a lovely hotel provided by EasyJet overnight.
Yeah.
Coach transfers, breakfast, the lot. We were well treated because we knew how to act as passengers. EasyJet gained tremendously because 5-6 of the passengers on that plane did their own thing for the night.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Now, to me, intelligent passengers are those who are knowledgeable and have the nous to act. This other wonderful story, 10 days ago, a mate of mine flew out to Tenerife with EasyJet, and a girl in the queue next to him came up with 5 big bags on her trolley. And the check-in staff said, "Wow, you're going to pay a lot." She said, "I'm not. It's all within." He said, "Come on, you only get 20 kilos.
Yeah.
And she said, "Yeah, well, there's not one of those bags above 20 kilos. Well, I'm sorry. There are travelers who don't understand traveling who are allowing low-cost airlines really to boost their revenue magnificently or increase their savings. As people become more intelligent and knowledgeable, and German travelers tend to be quite knowledgeable with nous, the airlines will have to modify their services and their provisions. It will cost them a bit of money, but it will bring them closer to traditional airlines and everybody will benefit. But that will take time.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
To me, I think the Ryanair model is longer term going to hit problems. And yet that's the one that has the massive United States investment.
Yeah.
70.5% of the investment in Ryanair is out of the United States.
Really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Chairman, remember, the chairman is still David Bonderman, who's Texas Pacific, or TPG, and their biggest shareholder, Capital Research, or Capital Group and Capital World, they own something like 20% of the airline. And that's a huge amount. And that is strangely the American model. The other low-cost airlines like EasyJet, Air Berlin, etc., are looking to other areas for their associations. Quite interesting, the dynamic. And Ryanair is the only one, really, that has pushed hard for its own routes into North America. Although, of course, people like Air Berlin with One World Alliance are now code-sharing with American Airlines.
Yeah.
Extraordinary story. Now, the whole thing is not what you'd think.
Tim, thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure.
Really appreciate it. I'm absolutely fascinated by what you've had to say. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, Peter. Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
But, you know, it's interesting what Peter was talking about in terms of the low-cost carriers and all the add-ons. And I came back from Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago on Southwest, and I don't know, for some reason the flight attendant and I got talking, and I said, isn't it interesting that Southwest prides itself on the fact that you don't have to pay for the bags. Right. They're free. And right. And people still bring bags on board that look like there's somebody in them and try to stick them in the overhead compartment. And anyway, my point of this whole thing was is that in the old days, Southwest used to be able to turn a flight in 20 minutes. When they first went into business back in the whatever it was, the 70s, that was their mantra. We can turn an airplane in 20 minutes. And now the actual time to turn a flight at a station has increased significantly. And the airline pretty much believes it's because these people are bringing all these bags on board. And it takes time to get them off. It takes time to get people in their seats now because they are dragging so much junk down the aisles. And I wonder if that's doing Southwest any good. I mean, to be giving them away for free, or maybe they need a new marketing plan that says, we really, really mean it. It's really, yeah. really free.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, just because the model is, you know, is successful for, you know, a period of time doesn't mean that the model remains successful. But I think what happens oftentimes more frequently with companies is they drift away from the essence of that model, the core of that model. I think I first heard this from Grant McCarron when he talked about low price carrier. I mean, there's a difference between price and cost. And I mean, we call them LCCs, but what we really mean is low price carriers. You know, what does the flying public pay? But in order to be profitable and be in that low price carrier category is you've got to be a low cost carrier. I mean, cost, the consumer doesn't see the cost, only the price. And some of these guys, you know, get that. And I think some struggle with it. But certainly Tim's got a lot of really interesting thoughts on this topic. And I hope Peter has an opportunity to bring us more from with his conversations.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was good. Okay. Okay, it's time for Grill the Geeks, and we've got a couple of questions. First one comes from another David. You know, I think that what we need to do is we need to ask our Davids who write in all the time to maybe put where they're from, just a city or something, so we can keep this straight. I know we've got David from Austin, but I don't know if all these Davids are the same David or different Davids. But anyway, here we go. This David says, okay, here's the question. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ready.
All right, now you're going to recognize who this is for. What does the K stand for in tanker designations, i.e. KC-135, KC-10, KA-6, et cetera?
Even I know that one.
Okay, Rob, go ahead.
Doesn't the K mean it's a tanker in itself? That's the designation for tanker, right?
And occasionally people have said it really refers to the word kerosene.
That's what David says. He says, yes, the K stands for kerosene. I never knew that. I won't bother leaving my address because I'm sure that the geeks can answer any tanker question by now.
It stands for kerosene? Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Now you do.
It stands for kerosene. That's where it was derived from.
All right, let's do one more. Let's see if I can find the next one. This one comes from Ben. Actually, this is ATC Ben, who you'll recognize from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. And let's see. Okay, interesting. He says, I'll give David a break and acknowledge I could never hope to stump him anyway without trying to ask for a specific part number for some obscure military aircraft. I wouldn't be surprised if David even knows part numbers. Although recently a Galeb jet has moved to be based out of Lilydale Airport, so maybe that can be put into the randomizer. It's interesting to see a jet operating off a grass runway. Okay, so now he says, on to the question, which is primarily for Rob. Let's see, he says, there are wake turbulence categories that are assigned to aircraft dependent on their maximum takeoff weight. Light, medium, heavy. And recently, the A380 created a new category, super heavy, or super for short. However, there are two air. Here's the question. However, there are two aircraft that defy this system with wakes worse than their assigned category. What types are they, and how must ATCs process them to allow for this?
Oh, I know one of them.
Well, I know one of them is the 757.
Well, that was the one I knew.
Yeah. The other one, though.
727?
Nah, because 727 was actually fairly light. It was only about 150,000 pounds, I think.
Yeah, but we're talking wake turbulence.
Yeah, but I don't remember anything strange about. I do remember all that strange stuff about the 7.5. Ooh, I don't know. I can say 7.5, but boy, I don't know what the other one is. Did 18? So you don't know, David?
No, I knew 7.5. I don't know the other one.
All right, Max, lay it on us.
All right, I've got to open up ATC Ben's email with the answers. Now let's see this. This answer comes in two parts. Let's see. Ben says, I'll do the answer in two parts, as answering the second question may give a clue to the first, if I've stumped you. All right, let's see. Grill the Geeks, answer part one. Okay, Ben says, whilst they are medium by MTOW, mean takeoff weight, ATCs must process these two as medium for spacing behind another aircraft and for spacing with a heavy or super following, but are considered heavy for spacing, which with a following medium or light. I don't know. Did you get that? All right. He says, stand by for part two answer. Part two. Okay, here we go. Oh, my. The two aircraft are both Boeing products, the 757, which you guys got, and the H-47 Chinook. Wow.
Hey, and I should have known that because that's built right around the corner for me.
That's right.
The Chinook has a wake turbulence. Wow, I've never heard that before. And what I think I want to know is, Ben, how did you figure that out?
That's a good question.
He must be like Dan. He must not have a life either.
Which is interesting because one of the advantages of the CH-47, especially when doing sling loading, is the front and rear rotors. They don't cause much ground turbulence compared to something like an SH-60 or something. It's one of the it's interesting that on a departure, it does cause wake turbulence.
Interesting.
Nice one, Ben.
All right, Ben, send us your address so we can send you a button. All right, we want to thank our listeners for sending in those questions. We have a number of them still in queue, but if you'd like to send us your question, make sure you send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. That's our email address. And if you figure that I won't know the answer anyway and you don't care to try to test that, then you can put the answer in that email. But otherwise, put the answer in a separate email. All right, moving on to listener mail. Once again, we have a huge amount of listener mail, and unfortunately, more than we're going to be able to get through. But let's try to do a few of them. Let's see. First came from Jeff. This is from a couple of weeks ago. Jeff says, I had a comment and then a news story I'd like to hear your thoughts on. First, a slight nitpick on David's report on the Space Shuttle Discovery, where he stated Columbia was never able to do that, which was docked to the ISS, due to its weight. Jeff says, while it was true that Columbia never did dock to the ISS, she was able to. NASA not only made modifications necessary to enable the installation of the external airlock and docking port necessary for docking, but Columbia was also scheduled to deliver the S5 truss segment before the accident. So a little correction there. Are you do you feel corrected, David?
I feel corrected. I sit corrected.
Okay, you sit corrected. I think Jeff knows his stuff. And then Jeff goes on, second, I was hoping to get your thoughts, probably Rob's, on the midair collision over Longmont, Colorado that occurred last month. What particularly surprised me about this was how far from the local airport this happened. The more damaged plane, which presumably crashed close to the site of the collision, crashed more than 7.5 miles from the airport as the crow flies. What might have caused the collision so far from the airport?
Yeah, as I understood it, the midair happened in a flight training practice area, and so that might have been the reason that there was this concentration of airplanes in one place at one time, and of course, where we practice out here north of O'Hare for our practice area, it's fairly large, but boy, it's amazing how many times you'll be out doing simple maneuvers, steep turns or stalls or slow flight, and all of a sudden, and you'll see somebody go sliding right across the top, and you know, it's hard, especially if the airplane doesn't have any kind of anti-collision warning system like some of the new glass airplanes have, and it's pretty tough.
Is anti-collision warning, is that common in general aviation airplanes or not?
It's becoming more common. I mean, for people that fly jets, we would have called it TCAS,
right? TCAS,
which is the traffic collision avoidance system. But yeah, there are many versions of it. I mean, the Cirrus that I teach in has one of those that's based on transponders, and it really does a marvelous job, because although it doesn't catch everything, it probably catches 95% of it. And boy, I'll tell you again, when your head is inside the cockpit and all of a sudden that guy starts yelling, traffic, traffic.
Yeah.
Whoa. You see somebody go past and you realize you'd have never seen them if that thing hadn't yelled at you. And so again, they are becoming much more common.
Hmm. Okay. Next email comes from Tom. He said, this is concerning our discussion about the Reno Air Race accident. He says, I've heard many different views regarding the Reno Air Race tragedy. Some of it was uninformed journalists doing their typical Chicken Little speak, while others are those in the air racing circuit or in the aviation world. Rob alluded to the NTSB's suggestion of the crowd being too close to the track. It was a good suggestion. Consider the nature of an air race. They are traveling in a circle. At some point, the energy of the 400-plus mile-per-hour aircraft will be momentarily directed toward the spectators. What happened to Jimmy Leeward and the Galloping Ghost was a failure that occurred at pretty much the perfect spot. A fraction of a second later, and it could have been only the Galloping Ghost and Jimmy who lost their life. He says, at air shows, the setup is entirely different. ICAS, the International Council of Air Shows, has very strict rules regarding air show performance. Performances. I would say that one of their most important concepts is energy management. This doesn't apply so much to the actual acrobatics, but rather the direction in which the energy of the aircraft is heading towards. At no point during a performance should the energy of an act be directed to the crowd in such a way that should a pilot lose control, the aircraft could end up hitting spectators. You guys are right. These are air races, not air shows. And then he closes, while I have never been to Reno for the races, I would love to attend. I also understand that what happened last year was an aircraft problem at a precise time, which led to the tragedy. Thanks for the show, guys. Tom, I really do want to attend the Reno air races myself someday. I don't know. Have you ever been, Rob or David?
Not me.
No, I never have either, actually. And you know, to the comment about the race circuit is a circle, I don't think that's completely true. The way I saw the race system or the race pattern at Reno, that was after the accident, was that it was a big oval, and that's a little different. And but I mean the point is still the same, that it was just absolutely the worst possible time for that airplane to go, you know, to fly out of control.
Yeah.
And it was only for a half a second that they were that vulnerable. But, you know, that is it was.
Okay. David got an email from Ernie White at the McCord Air Museum Foundation. David, I think that we were going to talk about this last time, but since you weren't here, we held it over. And this was about the listener, the international listener, I believe, who was denied entrance
to the museum, actually, and was Canadian.
Canadian.
And had all of the proper credentials according to the website. But considering he was Canadian, it was a foreign national. I did get a response from the museum. A quick one that said, I'm looking into this. I apologize for getting back to you sooner, and I haven't heard anything back since. So I'm following up. We're trying to get an answer, but it sounds like it's going to be very difficult because the museum is right in the middle of the base. And
yeah,
there's challenges to that.
Okay. Well, that's we're following up on that. And yeah, hopefully we'll have some more information because it's an interesting, it's an important issue. I think, you know, we want our international visitors to be able to have access to the museum spaces. Okay. Another email from Andy in the UK. Andy brings to our attention that this year is the 60th anniversary of the B-52. Is that right, David?
Yep. Absolutely.
It seems like the 50th just happened, but I guess that was 10 years ago.
Well, the youngest B-52 this year is celebrating the 50th anniversary.
Ah, okay.
So
the oldest is 60.
The oldest would be 60, and I need to prepare something about B-52s. We'll have to look into having that as being one of the airplanes of the week.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you do that in a 30-second segment.
Okay, good. Yeah, we'll look forward to that. That'd be a great idea. Amazing. 50 or 60 years. Wow. All right, so that'll do it for the listener mail for this episode. I want to thank everyone for writing in. We don't have time, unfortunately, to address all of them on the podcast, but we will continue to try to get to as many of them as we can. Okay, I think that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank again our guest, Linda Maloney, for joining us. We had a great conversation with her. You can find out more at her website. That's www.lindahidemaloney.com. Hyde is H-E-I-D. That's her maiden name. And also on Twitter at Military Fly Moms. We also want to thank our contributors, Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Also, Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. You can find more Peter at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. All right, now it's time to tell folks where they can find each of us online. David Vanderhoof, let's start with you.
You can find me online at my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Google Plus at David Vanderhoof. And you can find me on Twitter at DMVanderhoof. And lastly, if anyone is in the Mid-Atlantic area of the United States, next weekend is Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst open house. I'll be there probably Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So look me up, and I, of course, will have Airplane Geek pins. So if you see a geek walking around with an Airplane Geek pin button, say hi.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do people find you online?
Well, normally people find us at jetwine.com and Jetwine on Twitter. Tomorrow, of course, I'll be at the UPS office in our town shipping David a box of Airplane Geeks pins.
Great.
So he will be ready for that show next week. And I just want to make one last call that I hope everybody will trudge over to jetwine.com and take a look at that story we have about airport and airplane user fees, and go up and sign that petition to the White House to get them to come clean.
Yeah, please do that. And Dan Webb had to leave us a little bit early so he could work on his school projects. Dan Webb, of course, can be found on Twitter at Dan Webbage, or you can find his blog at
thingsinthesky.com.
That's right. Thingsinthesky.com.
I just wanted to see if we knew it.
Okay.
See, David, I'm telling you, Max doesn't think we can handle it without him.
I think I'm getting that feeling. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode of the Airplane Geeks at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to all the sites that we mentioned on the show. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And also, you can find us on Stitcher.com if you'd like to stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening. Hot as hell. Beautiful and relentless.
So, and they say that, crap.
Is that what they say?
I'd like to see that myself. I'm told that sometimes I act like a 10-year-old, but yeah, so I could help you edit. No, I don't know. Maybe not.
You're talking to someone who's sitting in a office with a carrier qualified A4M Skyhawk tailhook behind me. So,
oh well, I actually have a tailhook in my basement that I take with me. I go and talk to different schools, and I have this huge tailhook from a Prowler that my guys in my squadron gave to me when I left. And so it's down in my basement. I take it with me whenever I go and talk.
See, Rob, I'm not nuts.
I know. How much does that thing weigh?
It probably weighs about, I don't know, 50, 70 pounds. I don't. It's just the end of the hook. You know, it's just it's maybe 5 feet long.
Oh, well, see, I actually have the whole hook, including the mounting
gear. Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's really sad.
I love my hook. I won't give it away or get rid of it. We've moved a lot, and I always take it with me.